Hey, Heinrich, thank you for coming in and sharing your marvelous career. I mean, it is quite wonderful, all the things that you've done and all the contributions you're making. Definitely impactful and changing the world in many positive ways. So thank you again.
Thank you for the invite, and very nice to meet you again. Last time we met was in Rwanda. So, been a while.
The Impact Summit. So, Heinrich, you have this marvelous life, both professionally and personally, and so on. And it's just remarkable all the things that you've done. But what were those two or three inflection points that made this wonderful person you are today? And it could have been something that happened when you were three or five, or inside the family, outside the family, maybe something work-wise, or maybe in school. But there's got to be these three, let's say, magic moments that help shape your career and your
Yeah,
life.
absolutely. Absolutely. Let me just say something first, and which is every time people look at, people that have been successful or leaders, it always come across as glamorous and one-dimensional. But the truth of the matter is being an entrepreneur is very difficult. And so whatever you're seeing from the outside and what happens inside, I think many people that have been entrepreneurs know how hard it really is. So I just wanted to say my life is absolutely not just perfect. There's been lots of ups and downs in my life. Okay. But let me try to answer your question in terms of inflection points. I think firstly, of course, where you're born, the parents you're born to, the environment matters a lot. So I was lucky in the sense that I had a very entrepreneurial dad with a lot of ideas and had a very caring mom with a lot of empathy. So I think my childhood was one of safety. And I think that is important in terms of being able to live your dreams and actually being able to even dream. But in terms of inflection points, the first one I think about when I look back at my life was the job I had in high school. And here I met a guy called Alan. And he was a marvelous guy. He had started his career as a mechanic and built his career, creating a huge place for people coming in and fixing the cars. Unfortunately, he had an accident. And then he followed his life passion, which was tropical fish. So in a very early age, I was helping him out on breeding tropical fish, cleaning fish tanks and what have you. And the generosity he had was incredible. Often we would come as youngsters to the workplace and unprepared, tired, and he would always welcome us in the most warm way. He would give whatever he had to people coming by. And I think for me, early on, seeing that generosity and warmness in a leader was, for me, very, very inspiring. He always had time to talk with me when I had trouble or whatever was going on in my life. He really cared for people, and I took that away. And still today, I think that's one of the things that keeps me, driving and so on is on the business side, is actually seeing my colleagues and people in the sector succeeding. I get a lot of pleasure of that. So I think that was my first big inflection point. A second one was when I was around 19, 20 years old. I moved to Central America, to Costa Rica, and I also worked in Nicaragua and Panama, Guatemala. And for me, in such an early age, seeing poverty mattered a lot. So I was, born and raised in a middle-class family in Denmark, and never seen poverty to that extent that I saw in Central America. I remember in Nicaragua how people were living in small plastic huts next to the train rails, because that's the only place you could live more or less for free. And the house they're living in was not more than maybe 10 square meters, 15 square meters. And the kids were running on the tracks. I mean, seeing that in such an early age, I think was for me very profound. What I also learned there was that poverty doesn't mean that you can't be well informed. So a story sometimes tells about my time in Central America is that when you enter middle class in Costa Rica at that time, this is now many years back, the way you kind of proved to your community now you're part of middle class was you could afford a shopping trip to Miami. when I was in Nicaragua, what I saw was, and this is just after Sandinistas, I saw a lot of people that didn't have much money, but they were always having a book or a newspaper they're reading, and many of the streets were pretty clean, and they knew what was going on in the world. And for me, that was quite informative to understand that, you know, being poor doesn't mean that you can't be on top of many issues and you can't want a much better life. And so for me, that was a very big lessons learned for me in the sense of poor people can often be very resourceful in terms of their imagination or their drive, what have you. They just haven't had the opportunities many of us have had in their lives. And maybe a third inflection point in my life was my time when I was a student at Harvard University and later on when I worked for McKinsey early on. I think at the university, I saw an openness to new ideas. I saw a lot of incredible students. I also learned that there's no superhumans. Maybe there are a few, but most people really are successful because they work incredibly hard. And at McKinsey, I saw, you know, people and even myself working 80 hours a week. And I think I was impressed by how much the human body can actually absorb in terms of work capacity. And later on, when I've seen very successful entrepreneurs, a lot of it comes down to will and not giving up, and just working incredibly hard. So I think, Stephen, those are at least three inflection points that comes to mind in terms of my own life, what have shaped me early on.
So that's kind of remarkable. I'm just reflecting what you're saying. You're indicating that your family had a good heart and gave you the sense of empathy and curiosity and so on. And it was a really great upbringing. And then your friend and the giving sort of the servant leadership aspect of the friend, and then your experiences in South America and what you saw there. And again, this capacity for learning and being really conscious of what's happening around the world. And then when you're at Harvard and you're seeing that really there's just people really, really work hard, and you're talking about how you did the McKinsey and so on as well. So all of these helped shape you and to be very conscious and empathetic as to the needs of others. And I found in all the interviews I've done for like 40, 50 years that people have these broad backgrounds tend to be more empathetic or tend to have a broad perspective. And I can see that weaving into your background. So let's now go. So that's remarkable. I can see how that shaped you to where you are today. So you're studying in school, and then you end up with an undergraduate degree in political science. Can you talk about that journey? And then you end up with a degree in business economics, and you go on to getting a master's of public administration from Harvard. Can you talk about that educational journey and maybe some of the other things that you learned while you were in school?
Yeah, I think you're right that by being broadly, you know, exposed early in life, it enables you to see both, you know, where could you fit in, and also understand different topics from different areas. So for me, I was very conscious early on that instead of going down very deep in one topic, I want to study as broadly as I all could and in many different contexts. So which you probably haven't seen on my resume, but I also studied a bit in Spain and in the UK. So I've been around, and for me that was very important to have a very, you know, say broad formative education. And I think what it has enabled me is to step back once in a while and see the broader patterns. So I think, for instance, when you study philosophy or social science, you may see things that you don't see if you just have been studying business in a very, very narrow way. So for me, you know, both education at that point in time, but even today, I spend probably nearly an hour every day studying new articles, reading late at night. I think for me, it's a journey you're on, we're all on, and that is for sure. I think keeping me still a bit sharp, although I'm getting older, right? So my journey in terms of education has really been many different disciplines, many different locations, to make sure I could grasp as many issues as all possible.
Okay, so I can see now your earlier life, a very much a crucible of different experiences, and which is really great in terms of your personal growth, but also your view of the world. And then in your education, again, it's very multi-stakeholder, multidisciplinary, interdisciplinary, and transdisciplinary. So it really covers the entire spectrum of the integration of different kinds of thinking. And it kind of reminds me of this concept of innovators' DNA, where the more broad and the more open you are, and the broader the networks you have in your and also in your learnings, that it makes you just much more innovative and much more aware of what's happening. So I can see how all of these are building into your what you've been doing. But then you end up at the United Nations Development Program and at McKinsey. Can you talk about the experiences there and that help how that helped shape you as well?
Yeah. So in terms of United Nations, I got in very early, working first in the education sector in Peru, and later on in headquarters, where I had the fortune to work first in budget, but then directly working with the administrator on his new business plan back in the day. So there was a guy called Mark Miller Brown, who later became Deputy Secretary General, and right now works in the Soros Foundation as CEO. And it was very informative for me to, in a very early age, to work with a business leader like him, and seeing how you take a UN agency and transform it. It was 2 or 3, 4 years that were very, very hectic. And what happened was that I was working with UN and came to McKinsey and came back again and started Dalberg, which we can talk about in afterwards. But I think the seeing how the UN worked inside, and also understanding that the logics that are working in a national bureaucracy or working business absolutely don't work in the UN system. So for instance, if you talk about efficiency, a lot of people they will criticize the UN for its bureaucratic inefficiencies. And I always say, well, that's not how you should measure the UN. You should measure it on its effectiveness. Its effectiveness is the kind of dialogues that are taking place, the wars that are we avoiding, you know. And that's what you need to measure it on. So again, you know, being able to step back and fully understand what is in front of you, looking at it from a systemic point of view and not getting caught into the microcosmos here and there, I think for me was very, very rewarding and insightful, you know, insights I got there in my life. At McKinsey, I learned how to be very structured. That's not necessarily my personality, but seeing how having a robust method to problem solving, how far it can take you, regardless nearly of what is in front of you. And also seeing the work ethics, working in teams. It's a bit like a military SWAT teams where you go in and you work night and days to solve something for a client very, very fast. And I think that's something that I've taken with me my whole career afterward was, you know, we're always working teams and get different views in and let the best idea win. That's a theme we're using a lot in the company, which is it's not the person who's been in the firm for the longest or have the, you know, most credentials. It's the best idea that wins. So those are some of the things I took away from McKinsey and the UN.
And then you go on to found Dalberg, which has become, you know, one of the most, I would say, impactful organizations in the world today, and with all the different kinds of projects you're doing. Can you sort of describe that journey of forming the group and then how you've scaled what you've been working on? You know, for example, initially maybe you worked on UN reforms, and then you were, you know, you then start expanding. I mean, you have what, over 700 employees, something like that, and you do projects around the world, right? And across more than 100 countries. But what was that seed that got you started in forming the group? And then what was it like to grow the group, this consultancy, to this major powerhouse it is today?
Thanks so much for the compliments. Well, you know, what it really came down to was, you can say the learnings from both working for the UN and also working at McKinsey. And what I saw at Harvard back in the day was that some of the absolutely most talented people, they went into Wall Street and did, I would say, sometimes a bit mundane work, and they would definitely work for people that already were very, very rich. And then you'll see global issues like water, you know, conflicts going on, and it'll be dealt with by organizations that have very, very little resources. And so there was a mismatch in the market that some of the most capable people in the world, they were working things they shouldn't be working on, in my view. Like, we need to have the best brains, the most capable people working against the most difficult issues in the world. So that's how, you can say, Dalba came up, was creating a platform that enabled really smart, talented people to work on some of the most important issues in the world. And I know that is a very grandiose, you know, vision, but that was what we tried to do in reality. And we started with the UN. I had some connections there given my past. And we did a lot of strategy consulting on UN reforms for many years, because we felt that the UN was an organization and global platform that had and still has a very important role in the world. So that's how we got trained, you can say, on the global development sector. And then slowly we moved into also serving some of the larger foundations, as we saw they were starting emerging and had strong agendas, and we want to help them shaping those. And then we start working with governments and investors and companies as, you can say, global issues start emerging that became more mainstream. So when we started working, for instance, on climate change back in 2003, very few people took that issue, you know, seriously. But now look, 20 years later, and this is probably the issue that is shaping the risk profiles of most investors and companies today. So you can say our company was starting as a traditional developing consultancy, but have been growing as some of these issues, unfortunately, has become so big that we all need now to address them. So that's how you say Dalba grew. Now, then 10 years down the road or so, we basically had an internal discussion, which was around our business model. So at the end of the day, our company was set up for having impact. Everything we do is first impact, and then we figure out how we can earn money and pay our salaries, right? And so what we thought was, why being tied up to one business model if at the end of the day we are looking at impact as our most important goal as a company? And that's how we start expanding into research and into design and into media and into incubating new ideas, into implementation programs, and most recently into the AI field. So that's how we expand our capabilities, simply because we want to make sure that whatever we brought to our clients and to our partners were the most relevant capabilities we could offer. So that's a bit of the Dalba journey. Maybe a couple of more things about our company, which is that we are very much an open architecture. So we love partnering with organizations out there. It's important that we always try to come up with the best solutions. And we reckon that in many situations, we don't necessarily sit with the best solutions. But what we can do is we can help our client partners then identify the right ones and work with them. So that's an important part of who we are. And secondly, we also are quite interested in being accountable ourselves. So for us to be co-owning an issue with our clients and partners is important. They should feel that we care as much about their issue as they do themselves, which we do. The people coming to our companies, they don't come here to earn a lot of money. They're coming here because they think we are an interesting platform to make a difference. And so that's kind of the DNA of who we are.
I mean, it's really quite remarkable what you've done. I mean, as you mentioned, very early into looking at climate issues. And in fact, you know, the last, I guess, almost year and a half now, we've had over 1.5 degrees centigrade, right? It's actually gone over for the last now about a year and a half, and now the it's probably going to continue on. So it's a really serious, but you're identifying this 20 years ago, and you're promoting economic justice in the US and advancing global social development. And then, as you mentioned, scaling by collaborating across governments and corporations and foundations, nonprofits, but really treating the issues that they have as your own, as right. as being about passionate about all of those solutions and challenges as they are, and that's part of your DNA. And I can see how your upbringing and all the things that you've done are really part of this mosaic that creates this wonderful weave or fabric that you are today and you're doing with your Dahlberg group as well. But, you know, you played an important role in the founding of the Aspen Network of Development Entrepreneurs. Maybe you can talk a little bit about that and launching initiatives like DigiFarm and the Human Account and spearheading the Preventing Pandemics at the Source initiative. Can you talk about some of those and maybe a few others? And then we'll get into what your view is of the world today and trends.
Sure. Yeah, so I think it comes with the positioning of the market in the sense of we are getting so many impulses from our clients and partners in terms of what's going on. And sometimes, you know, there's a need to institutionalize. And in terms of the Aspen Institute initiative, it's, again, a very, very old one. What happened was that we saw that there were a number of organizations like ours that were using private sector methods in development. But what we didn't do is we didn't have a codex. We didn't meet. We didn't do joint training. But we had a lot of things in common. So generously, the Aspen Institute allowed us to meet in their facilities. And I think there was around 20 of us or so that met. And we found out that we had all these things in common. And over the last 15 years, how long it's been, this has evolved from being a one-off meeting to now an institute where standards being set and where the trainings are happening, etc. So that's kind of one of the examples of us trying to be helpful to the industry. And we have done this, as Stephen, you're saying, quite a few times. Also in terms of the impact investment space, we've been quite active back in the days. And it's something that we have been trying to look at as a duty in the industry as a firm. And it's something we have set up an organization called Dahlberg Catalyst with that purpose. It's basically taking good ideas, mostly not our own, to be very frank. The vast amount of ideas from others, and we basically help bring different parties together, different funding opportunities together in a nonprofit way. So we have absolutely no economic gains from this. To make sure that there are new institutions, new networks that are emerging. And as you said, one of the most recent ones we've done is around the pandemics. So what we saw, all of us on this planet 3 or 4 years ago, was how connected we were and how dependent in some way we are in terms of different countries, different cities are implementing good behaviors in terms of limiting pandemics. And we have then worked with, again, a consortium of around 20 players or so to focus on some of the root causes. So yes, there are the open meat markets that we need in some way to reform, but there's also the fact that cutting down the rainforest means a lot in terms of pandemics. So what we're trying to do is basically avoid, and that's not going to happen, there aren't going to be more pandemics, but we need to avoid the frequency of the number of pandemics. So it's a bit like climate change. We know the temperature will increase, but it's all about kind of mitigate the consequence. And that's what this consortium is doing.
I see. I mean, that's really fascinating. You know, preventing zoonotic viruses from spilling over, right? And
yeah.
There's even archaic viruses, right, that are being released through the tundra that it's melting. And we don't know what the impact is going to be because it's like literally millions and millions of these kind yeah. of new viruses that we're going to be exposed to. So it's really interesting what you're doing. And I can see why it's called Preventing Pandemics at the Source Initiative, because you're really
Yes.
going to the source. I mean, that's quite remarkable. Do you work with groups like the Sattel Institute at all, or are you aware of the Sattel Institute?
No, I'm actually not. So I'd love to hear about that. What do they do?
Well, it's an institute that was set up to get foundations and corporates really thinking about CSR, but in a demonstrated way. The only reason I know about it, because I've been asked to speak at it coming up, and they have a private summit coming up, but I've been asked to speak, and I got to know some of the things they do. So I'm thinking there's a lot of synergy between what they're doing and what you're doing. Maybe off offline, I'll join you
Yeah, wonderful.
with the chair of a summit coming up, and because the work that the chair is doing outside of Sattel Engineering, he's on the board. But again, I think there's a lot of synergy between what you're doing and what he's doing. I'm just kind of live brainstorming.
Yeah, that's good. I love that.
So you got all of this really remarkable work. We talk about climate, we talk about pandemics and so on. What are the other trends that are out there that you think we need to draw attention to in the world today?
Let me first get into climate a bit more, and then I would like to talk with a couple of other ones because I think climate is and biodiversity is incredibly important. And not to kind of close this party right now, but I think we all need to recognize that we're just seeing the top of the iceberg of climate change. So if people are concerned in terms of what they're seeing right now, this is nothing compared to what we're going to see as humankind. And I think there's a couple of things that, at least for me, are important that we start reckoning with in terms of climate change. And the first one is that we all need to take a personal responsibility. And I think it's very, very difficult. We all grown up in a paradigm where success to a large extent means you have a big house and you have a car and you travel a lot and stuff like that. But the planet can't handle that, particularly not when we're seeing new middle classes coming up in many of the emerging economies that want the same things we want to. It just don't work. And therefore, it's important that, yes, policymakers need to do things, but we ourselves need every single day to start changing behavior and see and look upon what is real success. And real success is something about protecting our planet and make sure that our kids have a good place to live. And if you look at the climate, some of the climate issues we have, I think it is that we have around 4 billion young people under 30 years old in this on this planet, and they have no voice in this issue. And we need to bring their voice in. They need to decide much, much more than what they're doing today. So that's one important thing. Another important thing is that we need to recognize the systemic issues we are confronting, which is that there's around 40 governments in the world that are heavily depending on export of fossil fuels to have the economy working. But there's just no way these economies are going to transition fast because they're going to lose elections, they're going to lose welfare, et cetera, et cetera. So we need to deal with that reality. And I think the last COP process showed how difficult it was to get agreement because there's just too much at stake on other dimensions from some of these policymakers, which means that businesses, cities, investors, etc., they need to move very fast on this. They can't be held back by governments, and it's in their own interest. From a pure risk perspective, it's in their own interest. And those governments, there needs to be a new deal. Because it has to stop. We need to get out of fossil fuel as fast as we can. We may think that we are doing a lot on climate, but right now we are emitting every day much more CO2 than we are absorbing. And that means that the situation is just getting worse and worse and worse. So that's a very, very important point in terms of climate change. We need to get out of fossil fuel ASAP. And we need to find ways to get some of the governments that are depending on fossil fuels to give them incentives to move on as well. So that's one thing. Another thing that I am spending quite a bit of time on is AI. I think AI is a technology that has is very potent, as we all know. It also has a lot of risk in it, and the policymakers are behind. Back in the day when we had the nuclear bombs developed, it was much easier to create constraints around it because we were few countries. Now we have technology everybody can access and can use and misuse. That makes it very, very dangerous. But there are also some incredible opportunities in it. And at least right now, I'm mostly focused on the opportunities because I think that a lot of folks in more difficult economies, people that don't have many means, they can get access, for instance, to healthcare in new ways, much more cheap and much better than they have today. So it has a phenomenal potential in terms of revolutionizing the welfare of the people at the bottom of the pyramid. So AI is something I'm very, very keen on working with partners on. So again, Stephen, if you know some people doing great work, we would love to work with them on this. A third thing that I think is important to discuss, Stephen, this one is migration. So in the same way as we can predict on climate the consequences of more CO2 in the air, there's going to be a completely parallel metric around migration. As climate change is increasing, so is the amount of agricultural land going to diminish. And there's going to be more and more people that are seeing their livelihood disappearing because of climate change. And they need to have jobs, so they're going to migrate. And some of them are going to migrate into big cities, but other ones are going to migrate into other countries. And we're not talking about tens of millions or 5 or 20 million. We're talking about possibly a billion people or so that need to relocate within my lifetime, probably even shorter than that. And that is massive. And we are not prepared for that at all in the world. Back in the day, we look at former civilizations, they could just migrate. There were no border controls. They just migrate to another better place. Today, that's impossible. So that is going to be a big challenge. It's also an opportunity. If we can create green jobs, if we can take advantage of the fact that in the global north, the demographics are so that we're getting less and less children, and in parts of the south, we're getting more children. So there's also an opportunity here to actually create a win-win, move certain jobs to the south, et cetera. There's many opportunities. But right now, we're not very structured around it, and we need to be that very, very soon. So those are like at least three things that for me are top of my mind.
You know, that's really, really fascinating. So definitely climate is escalating, and people don't realize the ramifications, all of these emergent areas, and how it can even create sort of an escalation, right, of building on it. There's novel technologies that could help address this, and new kinds of ways of thinking, quantum computing, perhaps, or supercomputing combined with new materials, new energy sources, and things like that. You're talking about on the climate side, the fact that we don't get the 4 billion youth, that their voices aren't heard, but we're also custodians of life in general on the planet who have no voice.
Right.
And so we have to represent all life, not just human life, and the impact. Right. So just thinking about that, and it's interesting on the immigration side, there's a lab called the Foresight or the Future Tales Lab. It's part of a company called DDGO, which is a conglomerate, and one of their companies is MQDC, and they're actually doing quite a bit of research on the implications on the urban areas. Of climate and how the whole structure of cities and have to completely change, and also the ecosystems on coastal areas have to completely change, and it's quite dramatic the pronounced changes, but which in turn then touches on immigration, as you mentioned, right? And it's the billion sort of plus, but then again, if you look at all life, it's sort of like in the trillions or in the hundreds of billions, right? And that's just because we're custodians of all life, so. I guess we could spend an entire day just sort of mining the implications of just those three areas. Yeah, that's really quite fascinating. I'm just thinking of all the things that I'm engaged with, and then you talked about AI and the implications of AI. And there's this thing called ESMVol, this large language model, which they applied to how amino acids fold into proteins. And 5 years ago, the known protein universe of how amino acids fold into proteins, that knowing that structure, was about 200,000. Implying this technology is now at 600 million, right? So, or Microsoft using something called Microsoft Quantum Elements, and which has AI embedded in it, but also high performance computing or supercomputing and quantum inspired algorithms. And really, they applied it to a new, actually looking at 32 million different kinds of battery novel material combinations. And really, within a short period of time, they came up with a new battery design, and they actually prototyped it, and it works, right? So, but AI is a big part of that. So the implications, I guess, AI is just so profound. I'm definitely connected in that area. So maybe off, and I can do some, knowing what you specifically where you want to go or things you want to do. Are you part of the Knowledge Impact Network, by the way, the 1,000 leaders that are working on projects globally, and they're providing mentorship and sharing their knowledge? Are you connected with that group and Alain Chatrit?
No, I'm not. So it seems like I'm getting a lot about this podcast. So thank you so much if you can introduce me.
Yeah, I mean, it's
We'd
really
love to. We'd love to connect with people that are like-minded, obviously.
definitely like-minded, and what he's doing in the community he's trying to build. But there's other people like Chaco Valeyappa and the work he's doing. Have you talked to Chaco by any chance with the Soda
No,
Group?
I haven't. No, but let me just give you a little picture of what I think AI can do in health, given you have an interest in tech. So let's say we have a pretty poor country with 50 million people or so, right? And poor healthcare. So the way you typically will do it, you will create a strategy and saying, how is it we as a nation can get better healthcare? You'll be constrained, from government finances. Then you let, at the end of the day, when you have your strategy ready, you apply for a big loan, probably to the World Bank. And then when you get that, 7 years have happened, and then you start building your next generation hospitals, right? That is the way I've been brought up in development sector, right? Now look it into an AI reality. An AI reality could be that you provide all citizens with an app in terms of preventive health. So yes, if you can get people to have another lifestyle, that's the biggest saving you can have at all. And we really put that even in the OECD countries, right? So you can give people an ability to basically live a better life. Then you can have self-identification, self-diagnosis, right? So you can scan with your mobile phone, you can scan your skin and see whether this is something you have there that is serious or not. If it's not that serious, you can go to a local clinic. They may again use an AI app to kind of help you treating it. If it's very serious, yes, then you go to the major hospital. So what happens is you have reduced costs significantly in that process. So instead of a person looking at their arm and saying something is wrong, using like the major hospital, you're actually only getting the ones that are really, really serious. So by that, you can reduce cost with AI and you can increase quality because the data they have access to is the same data set that they're using at MIT or at Sloan Kettering or whatever it is. And what happens is the more time people are using this app, the more start getting knowledge about that specific country's DNA makeup, right? As you know, most research, medical research today is done on Caucasian men, most likely in the north. We don't know much about the Bantu tribes in the Congos. So suddenly you can start moving into personalized, health as well. So AI can provide a lot of opportunity. And instead of you can say that government in the beginning, we're going through this whole long process. Maybe they're just starting a tender process saying, who can provide those kind of tools to our population? And maybe then go to a big foundation and say, if we pay half of it, will you help you guys pay the other half, and maybe it's just, you know, $1 per person per year. Like there's new business models that have completely other speed and ability to provide much, much better healthcare, possibly if we get them deployed right. But it comes down to also, of course, how do we treat data? How do we create data? There's a lot of things here that are difficult around governance and integrity that needs to be sorted too.
You know,
so it's not easy, but the potential is significant, very, very significant.
So, Heinrich, have you gone to AI for Good?
Yeah, we know of them, yes. Yeah.
But you've attended the AI for Good Summit?
My colleagues have. I haven't myself.
Right. We have something called the Innovation Factory, where every time there's a pitching contest, there's definitely AI applied to healthcare. And the ways that you're mentioning, so there's an open platform for innovation, but I'm connected with it. But there's also the World Food Program. They have probably the largest humanitarian fund and accelerator. And again, because it's food, but health is connected to food, and climate is connected to food. You'll find that the portfolio companies being scaled in there or being incubated in there also have the elements. Are you connected with the World Food Program and their innovation accelerator? Okay, so.
I'm not personally my colleagues. We've worked with them for many, many years, but not particularly on this one. I'm not involved in everything in our company. We have an extraordinary amount of very, very talented colleagues that are running many different interesting projects with different clients. Yeah.
I'm thinking David Ruett, he's the chief medical officer at Microsoft. They've created a lot of content and tools and capabilities, and now they're scaling through community, right? So maybe that's somebody you haven't networked with. So he's the chief medical officer of Microsoft, and he's responsible for the whole sort of ecosystem and what they're getting involved with. And AI is a big part of it, right? Because of the scale you mentioned. Well, we're actually a little bit over time. I'm actually happy to have the interview, but we have time for one last question, and that is anything more you want to say about the future, and then also your last recommendations you want to give to the audience?
Yeah, let me just end with just like a philosophical point of view, which is that I think the way we set up the market economy today is one where a lot of companies are producing goods, where there are significant negative externalities, and it's some way the governments need to pick it up, right? That model is fundamentally flawed. Like it's built on, you know, the early industrialization. We haven't really done much in terms of changing, you could say, the whole concept here. And I think we need to get into a place where every time a company is producing, they need to create good for the planet. And it's difficult. But I think we need to set up some goals saying, for instance, that if you're a company, either you are involved in getting Mother Nature back to where it was back in the day, or you are involved in creating long, healthy lives for people. But then they need to be tied up into something that is providing long-term benefits for all of us. And I know it sounds kind of difficult, but I think it's on all of us as business leaders to really think through whether it makes sense to create products that are, you know, giving kids obesity, or, you know, it makes people not focused in traffic, or whatever it is. Like, we all need to take responsibility. So I think that's the you know, just one point for all of us to consider, that we need to challenge how businesses is operating. Every time a unit is being produced, the world needs to be a better place. It can't be a worse place. We need to take responsibility as business owners and business leaders. In terms of an advice, you know, I think I'll just circle back to my opening paragraph. So my dad, as I mentioned to you before, he was very innovative and dynamic. He was a CEO, and my mom, she was a teacher. And when I look back at my dad unfortunately passed away. When I look back at their lives, then my dad was, you know, always a bit stressed what's going on, while my mom she just loved her craft. And I remember, you know, waking up one morning where, you know, some of the students, they were singing a song in our yard because it's her birthday. And when we walk down the street in our local city, everybody knows her. And so I think it's important we all reflect upon what is really success in life. And I think when I look at my dad's and my mom's life, I think actually my mom has been a more successful person than my dad. And that's not how we reward today people and how we look upon people. So I just wanted to say that let's really reflect upon what is success, both for ourselves, but also for the future we're building, all of us together.
Yeah, so really more than a 360, I call it maybe a 720 degree view of an omni win, where you're really making sure that everybody wins, right? And then you double down on it. So it's a very outward sort of a facing view, not just for me, but it's for everyone, right? So, I mean, it's remarkable all the things that you shared today and the work that you're doing, and we just touched a little bit of it. It's just you are just really amazing what you've done, so, and continue to do. So thank you for coming in and sharing your insights with our audience.
And thanks for allowing me. Thanks so much for that, Stephen.
Thank you for listening to The Brand Called You videocast and podcast, a platform that brings you knowledge, experience, and wisdom of hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. Do visit our website, www.tbcy.in, to watch and listen to the stories of many more individuals. You can also follow us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Just search for The Brand Called You.